The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody wants everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In-your-face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello and welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today we'll be joined by a dear friend of mine, legendary, and I do mean legendary, sportscaster Bob Costas. But before we get started with Mr. Costas, this from Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. Welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast. It is Hall of Fame weekend in baseball, and there's nobody better to talk about that subject with than Bob Costas. He has been my friend for 35 years. We have spent the last year and a half having a ball working on his memoir slash autobiography, which he insists on calling Tuesdays with Maury. I don't know why. Nobody.
Just for residuals. It's a good commercial play, Mike. Come on.
Nobody in the history of sports broadcasting has had a career quite like Bob Costas. That is not prejudice. That is the facts of the all of the things he has done across his broadcasting career. And even to say sports broadcasting is too limiting. He is not yet in the Hall of Fame, but will be, I believe, soon enough. He is on his way to Cooperstown this afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Costas.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lupica. Yes, right, not in the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame. And if I ever get there, whatever other honors have come my way, given my affection for baseball and given those who would have preceded me with that honor, if I ever get there, that might be one of the great days. In fact, it will be one of the greatest days of my professional life, if it should ever happen.
Well, again, Costas and I kind of got to New York at the same time. We have known each other forever, and I stupidly, and I'm telling this on myself, I said to him the other day, are you in the Hall of Fame? But you explained to me why you have not yet been eligible for the Broadcasting Hall of Fame.
Yeah, they have rules, and those rules make sense, I guess, when they first put them in place. A candidate had to be someone who had been a local broadcaster for 10 consecutive years with a team, or heard on network radio or television for 10 consecutive years. So when I did the Game of the Week on NBC with Tony Kubek, it was from 1981 through 1989. Then NBC lost the contract. Then they got it back again in 1995 through 2000 and lost it again. So I started doing baseball once again on the MLB network in 2009. So I guess as long as I don't hit a speed bump somewhere in the next year or so, yeah. I guess I will log 10 consecutive years. And they've also, over the years, changed. Instead of lumping everybody together, it's dawned on them, and I think correctly, that there are some pioneer broadcasters who are being shortchanged because of the understandable idea that if they're not around anymore, we're going to vote for someone who can still smell the roses. So there are some pioneer broadcasters, almost all of them radio people, from the 30s, 40s, maybe even into the 50s, who are put in a separate category. And every third year, that's the only category considered. And every third year, the only category considered is national broadcasters, because Joe Buck or Al Michaels are not the same as Marty Brenneman, for example, who's already in the Hall of Fame and should be many years with the Cincinnati Reds, or Ernie Harwell or Jack Buck or someone like that. And then every third year, it's local announcers, be they radio or television, who broadcast for one team. That makes more sense instead of grouping everybody together, separating them, and then every third year, voting for people who are apples to apples.
We're talking to Bob Costas on the Mike Lupica Podcast, and you know, Bob's love and passion for baseball is well known. He wrote an extremely well received, best selling book about baseball. Was it like 15, Bobby? 2002, Fair Ball?
2000.
2000, so that's 17 years ago. So frankly, Bob, it was time for another book, but which is a way of leading up to, and we keep saying we're not going to talk about the book with people, but it begins and ends with World Series. Bob, it begins and ends with World Series games.
Well, baseball, despite all the other things I've done, and I've been lucky enough to check a lot of boxes, baseball is the thing that always has resonated the most with me. And I'd like to think that when I've had my A game going in baseball, that not only have the broadcasts been good, but that my connection to the game has been palpable to the audience. One of the things that has bothered me a little bit, even though I'm not going to be too hard on myself, but you and I have talked about this, baseball is a rhythm thing.
Yep.
So in the 80s with Kubek and in the 90s with Euchre and then Joe Morgan, I was in a rhythm. You'd be doing a whole series of games. Sometimes in the postseason in the 90s, you do the division series, the LCS, followed by the World Series. You get in a groove. In recent years with the MLB Network, as much as I've enjoyed it, I'm often parachuting in and for a single game and with multiple partners. So it's taken me a little bit longer to get in the groove. I think I'm getting closer, but just when I think I'm there, something will just be slightly off. And then, as you know, because I'm not at all self-critical, I'll only beat myself up about it for about a week, maybe a month.
We're talking to Bob Costas. I told Bob I had my annual breakfast at Wimbledon with Billie Jean King a couple of weeks ago, and she was asking me what was going on. I told her a little bit about Bob's book, and then we had a conversation because we led into it by talking. She talks about how tough she still is on herself, whether she's given a speech or something. And I said, well, then there must be a genius club where people have that, because I said I listen to these games that Bob does with Cod or Small or whomever, with Smalls or whomever, and I said I think they're terrific, but if there's one speed bump in a 9-inning, 3.5-hour game, Costas will go back and look at it and tell himself that's not going to happen in the next game.
Yeah, because you're trying to figure out why it happened. And I think anybody who's reasonably good at what they do, you do have to learn for your own sanity not to brood over it too long. You want to take a look at it. It's like a coach or a quarterback or a pitching coach and pitcher going over the video. Why did you hang that curveball? Why did you throw into that crowd and suffer the interception? What could we have done better? So even if the broadcast was 95% what you want it to be, you really want to focus rather than just reveling in the parts you like. You want to focus on why did that happen? And is there something I could do to avoid having it happen again?
Talking to Bob Costas, who is on his way to perform various duties at Cooperstown for Hall of Fame weekend. Before we get to this Hall of Fame class, and there's a lot of ground to cover on the Hall of Fame because you make more sense about the Hall of Fame than anybody I know and are more balanced about it, especially the steroid stuff, than anybody I've ever talked to about it. I talked to your old broadcasting partner, Joe Morgan, last night, and my old friend, and I love Altuve. You love Altuve just because he's become this kind of presence in the game. Now, Joe was pretty emphatic. And again, I know that he was kind of preaching to a choir with me about Altuve. He said he's the best all-around player in baseball. And he said nothing against Trout. He said, I love Trout. He thinks Altuve this season is the best all-around player in the game.
Well, Altuve may well wind up being the American League's MVP because, after all, the Astros will win their division going away. They'll have the best record in the league. Aaron Judge, as much of a phenom as he has been, and it's likely going to become a Hall of Fame player, but he's tailing off just a little bit post-All-Star break, and it's possible that if the Yankees make the playoffs, they'll make it as a wild card. So those factors will work in Altuve's favor, and he will be the MVP of the American League, quite possibly, because the Angels don't look like they'll make the playoffs, and Trout missed a considerable portion of the season with a hand injury, and he was on his way, if it's even possible, in his sixth year in the game, having finished either first or second in the MVP balloting each of the first 5 years of his career.
Right.
He was on his way, statistically, to his greatest season to date until he hit the disabled list. So that doesn't mean that Altuve, over the course of his career, is going to be better than Aaron Judge or better than Bryce Harper or better than Mike Trout, but he might be this year's MVP.
Bob, Zach Lupica, who works at the Major League Baseball Network, sent me. I thought I had all the good stats on Altuve. Since the start of the 2013 season, he's got nearly 1,000 hits, which is the most in the game. Since the start of the 14 season, he has 112 hits more than the next closest guy, who happens to be Charlie Blackman. And you know, the one comparison I made in the column I wrote about Altuve with Joe was, you know, Joe's on the same team with Rose. He's on the same team with Branch. He's on the same team with Perez. I'm not comparing the talent in the room on the Astros, but there are other guys to watch. And sometimes you just have to take a step back with this kid and say, he is putting together a page, and you know, I date myself by talking about the baseball encyclopedia. He's putting together a page that gives off a beam of light.
Well, plus, because his name starts with an A, only Hank Aaron, I guess, would be ahead of him among Hall of Fame players. Yeah. Tommy Aaron would be ahead of him, and I'm not pretending to know everybody whose name started with A in the history of baseball, but you'd come to Altuve pretty quickly. My old friend Joe probably has a bias toward Altuve because of size and because of the position that they each played, second base. The big difference is that Morgan walked a lot.
Yeah.
Morgan walked over 100 times a season. And you can't be a hit accumulator like Altuve or a hit accumulator like the great Ichiro and walk 100 times. It doesn't work that way.
Bob Costas not only is steeped in the history of the game, he reads more about it. He is more current with the game than anybody I know. So, Bob, you are aware, as I am aware, of all the talk about this particular Hall of Fame class and how it's, rather than the Hall of Fame, they should be calling it the Hall of Good this year. Talk about, in any particular order you want to, Robert, the Hall of Fame merits of the three players going in.
Well, if you just look at it in terms of defensive prowess and what he did offensively, and you discount any of the whispers about PEDs, Pudge Rodriguez should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer. He was phenomenal behind the plate. I mean, he's your link between Johnny Bench and Yadier Molina as somebody who was just eye-poppingly good as a receiver and as a defensive catcher, and those, for people who know baseball, are distinctly different things, and Bench and Molina and Pudge excelled at all three of those things. Right. And he hit uncommonly well for a catcher. However, there were those PED whispers. Jeff Bagwell has huge numbers greater than people who we think are certified first ballot Hall of Famers. But he did it during an era of offensive distortion. There's no question about that. All circumstances worked in favor of the hitter during the prime of his career. And he was, again, whispers associated with PEDs. I think what happens with these two guys getting in and with Bonds and Clemens in their fifth year of eligibility, having jumped from the 30s into the mid-50s, and probably getting to 75% before their 10 years of eligibility are up, what that's going to mean is that even if some voters withhold the vote on the first ballot, just as a recognition that guys were either connected to or suspected to have used PEDs, the prohibition against PED guys is over with. And I think what that will also mean is that veterans committees will have to reconsider the likes of Mark McGwire. Now, will they make distinctions? Will somebody say, you know what? Mark McGwire could very well have been a Harmon Killebrew-like right. Hall of Famer. He wouldn't have hit 70 home runs. He wouldn't have had that home run rate, hit a home run once every 7.5 or 8 times at bat in his biggest years. But he could have been a Harmon Killebrew-like Hall of Famer. Entirely possible. And so he deserves to be in. On the other hand, would Sammy Sosa have done what he did without PEDs? Now we're into speculation, but I could see some people making those distinctions. But I do think there's going to be a reconsideration of a lot of people, because once the most prominent guys are in, and once guys about whom there are whispers, and there are, are in, then how can you continue to split hairs and say yes to this guy, no to that guy? I think they're all in with some sort of, if not official asterisk, then mental asterisk by their names. And the Hall of Fame prides itself on being both a museum as well as a hall of honorees. And it prides itself on being a reliable chronicler of the game's history. And so the Hall of Fame ought to have, as it does for various eras and milestones in the game's history, it ought to have an ongoing display apart from the hall where the plaques are hung, an ongoing display that details the effects of the steroid era and lists some of the players, including Hall of Famers, who were convincingly connected to it. But I don't think it's going to be possible to keep most of these guys out. The third guy is Tim Raines. Tim Raines is helped. He got in right at the end of his eligibility, but he's helped by sabermetrics. And I'm not saying that with a sneer. I think Tim Raines was a great, great player, especially during the six or seven best years of his career. He was hurt a little bit, at least at the time, by being the National League's version of Ricky Henderson. Ricky Henderson was in a class of his own, so Tim Raines could never be the best leadoff hitter in the game. So that hurt him a little bit. But when you go to sabermetrics and you compare him to other people who are in the Hall of Fame, he comes out pretty well, so I have no problem with him getting it.
We're talking with Bob Costas on the Mike Lupica podcast. Much more with Bob after this from Exxon and Mobil Synergy Gasoline. Engineered to provide better gas mileage, lower emissions, and improve engine responsiveness with seven key ingredients. Stop by your nearest Exxon or Mobil station today to experience Synergy Gasoline. To see and read Bob's full discourse on what to do about the steroid era in baseball, you're going to have to wait till next year to read the book. But Bob, bumper sticker, what you say the commissioner's message should be to the hall, to voters, about a realistic approach to this whole subject.
Well, the guideline that I would suggest would be, if you believe, like with Clemens and Bonds, if you believe they would have been and actually were Hall of Fame quality players before they began taking PEDs, I can see a legitimate reason for voting for them. When we had all the uproar about steroids, my position even then was not to punish individuals or shame individuals, but to clean up the game. And I don't think there's anything contradictory about saying that Barry Bonds was one of the greatest players ever on his natural merits, that he's a Hall of Famer, and it's silly to keep him out of the Hall of Fame, but that some of his records are inauthentic. There's a difference between authenticity and morality or criminality. The people who keep insisting that, well, yes, this guy did steroids, but this guy from 100 years ago was a bad guy, and this guy did this or that, or this guy drank too much, or this guy used greenies. None of those things affected performance on the field remotely the way steroids did. The only thing that affected performance on the field as dramatically as the use of steroids did was the change from dead ball to lively ball. And everybody recognizes that. So I think if we recognize that nobody hits 70 home runs, and more importantly, nobody hits a home run once every 6.5 or 7 times at bat without being on steroids, and that the true single-season home run record still belongs to Roger Maris, and the true career record still belongs to Hank Aaron, and in the next breath say, but I believe that Barry Bonds has been shamed enough, and we all get it, and he can go into the Hall of Fame, I don't see a contradiction there.
We're talking to Bob Costas on the Mike Lupica podcast, and at this point in this friendship, I cannot remember what we talked about on the last podcast, what we talked about for the book, or what we just talked about on the phone one day. But I know that we had a conversation, and you were dead on right about what the Jim Leland film or documentary, whatever you call about it, on the MLB Network. And you said to me,
look, people got to look at the Bonds as he presents himself in the Leland thing and wonder why he didn't do this more often.
Oh, yeah. When you look at that documentary put together by the great Bruce Kornblatt at the MLB Network, and Bonds was willing, very willing, to participate because of his regard for Jim Leland. That Barry Bonds, that big winning smile, the intelligence, the understanding of the game, the willingness to say, he, Leland, was right when he read me the Riot Act, and I was wrong, and I deserved it. And to say I'd go through a wall for this guy, that Barry Bonds is so likable. He had so much going for him in addition to his talent. He should have been not just a great, great player, which he was, but he should have been a beloved player, or he could have been a beloved player. But we didn't walk in his shoes. His dad, Bobby Bonds, had a rough go of it. In a different era, he was subjected to some racist treatment. That stayed with Barry Bonds. There was a chip on his shoulder. I think Barry's a fascinating psychological study, and I don't pretend to know the answers to all of it. But I do know that within him, there wasn't just baseness. There was a keen intelligence, both about the game and about the world, and a likability when he wanted to be likable. There were a couple of times when he was playing when he just kind of beckoned me over, and I sat on a stool by his locker, yep. And we had fascinating conversations, and he was very charming. And obviously, if he had just gone where his natural merits would have taken him, and he hit 600 home runs, and he had all the gold gloves, and maybe he wouldn't have won 7 MVPs, but he would have had multiple MVPs, and he would have waltzed into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot. And then if we learned what we learned about the steroid era subsequently, and he was not part of it, he was not suspected. He was sort of in Ken Griffey's category. He'd be in such a better place than he is now with 762 home runs. He'd be in such a better place had he gone that way than the way he did.
You know, again, we're talking to the great Bob Costas on the Mike Lubica podcast, and you're getting a sense listening to this conversation what it was like working on the book. But you just touched on something, Bob, that would be almost a fascinating book. I honestly think it would be a book. Bonds and Griffey Jr., okay, both the sons of Major League Baseball players, mm-hmm. both the sons of accomplished Major League Baseball players. And those conversations that you talked about with Bonds, I had them too. And one day at Shea Stadium, I had one for an Esquire piece, and he went into this thing, and obviously it kind of still burned him. He said, Jr. was the golden child. I was never the golden child, but what you were just saying is nothing prevented him from being that, Bob.
No, and even the fact that he left Pittsburgh to go to San Francisco, there was a connection with his dad in San Francisco. He knew that the Pirates, even if they kept him, wouldn't have been able to keep Van Slyke and wouldn't have been able to keep Bonilla and Drabeck, and that the team was breaking up. They would have gotten over that. Especially if he did, as many players do, express appreciation and thanks to a place where a good portion of his career had taken place, and hope you understand that I'm moving on. That would have faded into memory. He could have been that. He had it within him, but there was something else churning inside of him that prevented that. You know, it's instructive to recall that in 1999, when baseball fans, along with a panel of experts about the game's history, selected the all-century team, Ken Griffey Jr. was on it, and Barry Bonds was not.
Talking to Bob Costas on the Mike Lubica podcast, there's one other prominent inductee this weekend that we have not discussed, and even his legacy is complicated, and that is Alan Bud Selig. And, you know, we both like him. I think we both have a grasp and an understanding of his strengths and weaknesses. Place him, Bob, place him in historical context, because other than Kennesaw Mount Landis, nobody presided over this game at a more complicated time. And I'm even with the Black Sox, I'm not even sure that you could say that Landis presided over it at a more complicated time than Selig.
If you had to pick a single word that would be fair and put it alongside Bud Selig's name, I think that word would be impactful. You didn't have to agree with everything he did, and certainly I didn't, to see that he had a significant impact on the history of the game, and much of it for the better. If you looked at his midterm grade, it might have been a C. But in the second semester, he probably got an A minus, and maybe that averages out to a B or a B plus. I have no problem with him going into the Hall of Fame. But what it does bring up is the continued exclusion, foolishly and almost disgracefully, of Marvin Miller. Again, you don't have to agree with everything Marvin Miller ever said or did. Toward the end of his life, when he was done as the director of the Players Association, he, for a very smart man, sounded very silly, denying that steroids were an issue or that they had a significant impact on the game. He was dead wrong on that, and so were his acolytes, Don Fear and Gene Orza, despite all the other good work they may have done. But having said that, how can you write a history of the game without Marvin Miller showing up very prominently? Marvin Miller not being in the Hall of Fame is a black mark on the Hall itself. Now, this isn't Bud Selig's fault, because Bud himself has said, despite his own battles with Marvin Miller, that Marvin should be in the Hall of Fame. Bowie Kuhn, who was a very nice man, was defeated at every turn by Marvin Miller. Bowie Kuhn is in the Hall of Fame. Marvin Miller is not. So good for Bud, and I'll be there applauding when he makes his speech. But Marvin Miller being excluded and now, you know, gone, just wrong.
We'll have more with the great Bob Costas after this from ZipRecruiter. Whether football, basketball, or baseball is your sport of choice, you know that the key to winning is a strong roster. So when you're hiring in business, you need to get the best talent and use ZipRecruiter. At ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your position. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of the jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate, listen to this, in just 24 hours. And right now, my listeners can start forming their own winning team on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. Try it for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/Lupica. Try to Bob Costas on the Mike Lupica podcast. You know, it's funny that what seemed to be one of the most insignificant and ridiculed moments of Selig's commissionership, or whatever you want to call it, was when he got survey testing in after the, you know, after collective bargaining negotiations that I am told were as contentious as any there have ever been, that the room was as vicious, Angelos and Orza and all that time.
Yeah.
And people mocked him for getting that survey, Bob. And when we look back on it, and we talked about this, when you look back on it, were Fear and Orza in such denial that they thought that that would just be a speed bump, that survey? Could they have possibly not known the extent of the drug use at that time?
I guess they didn't want to know. And these are among the smartest people I've ever encountered, and I'm sure you feel the same. And you don't have to agree with someone to say that they are principled. I never found them to have lied. They might have been unreasonable. They might have had blinders on at times. But I always found them to be honest, and in the big picture, they were very effective. But they came a cropper on this whole steroid issue. And I guess they felt that if the players had enough warning in the offseason, and there was just survey testing in spring training, that none of them would be dumb enough to trip the test. But and the threshold was 5%, and as best we can understand, some 7%. Simultaneously flunked both the PED test and the IQ test, and that led to more testing and eventually more significant penalties.
You know, I called you when I was writing a Pete Rose column recently, and I said, do you think I should write it? And you said, you can't ever go wrong with a Pete Rose column. No. if you want to get people fired up, or on a slow day in December, if you're doing talk radio and you raise the subject of Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. But we are in agreement about this, Robert. His name should be on the ballot.
This is one that baseball needlessly complicated and created a decades-long controversy when there really didn't have to be any.
Right.
They should always have been separate issues. Banned from baseball? Absolutely. The evidence supports that. Never draw another paycheck directly from baseball. Yep. Never be in uniform again, except maybe at an old-timers game or some sort of ceremonial occasion, but never coach, never manage, never be directly involved. Unfortunately for Pete, his own actions in violation of a well-known rule means that he deserves that punishment. But what does that have to do with all those hits he got before any of the gambling charges were leveled against him?
Right.
It would have been a very simple thing to say. He's on the Hall of Fame ballot. Let the voters decide whether what he did with gambling violates the integrity clause, which seems pretty malleable when you consider some of the people who are in and some of the people who are out. Let the voters decide. Then the controversy goes away. And I don't think the walls would come tumbling down if Pete had a plaque in the Hall of Fame, which along with all of his achievements says banned from baseball indefinitely or for life in 1989 for gambling. Wouldn't what has already happened to Pete and that plaque on the wall forever, long after he's gone, wouldn't that be cautionary tale enough? I can't imagine any little freckle-faced 12-year-old kid walking through the Hall of Fame and saying, "Hey, Dad, look, Pete Rose. I guess that means it's okay to gamble on baseball, huh, Dad?" I don't think so.
We're talking to Bob Costas on the Mike Lubega podcast. And again, and this is the short list. I'm sure somebody else will come along someday to do the Olympics and the World Series and the NBA Finals and host Super Bowls and host Triple Crown races and host a late night talk show. And by the way, you'll have to wait for the book. But the turndowns of his career, the things he's turned down would be a Hall of Fame career in broadcasting. But he is on the road to Cooperstown today, and we're talking baseball because it's really, really fun to talk baseball with Bob Costas. Bobby, I've always wanted to ask you, how do you, in the course of a broadcast, and you have tremendous support at the MLB Network, including from your son and Keith, my godson, how do you keep the flow of the game going with all of the exit velocity and all the stuff that has become part of the modern baseball broadcast, and which is a long way for me to say, how do you keep the flow going with all that stuff that is like pro forma parts of a baseball broadcast now?
You know, this isn't a complaint, but it's just a recognition of the reality that you're talking about. I've gone to YouTube and taken a look at some of the games I did in the 1990s for NBC. And even though it's a commercial enterprise, it wasn't nearly as cluttered. And so the flow, and that flow includes silences between pitches, it just had a rhythm and flow to it that's very difficult to maintain given all the drop-ins and all the obligations to StatCast and all the strike zone boxes and all the exit velocity and everything else. And I understand that there's a place for that, but it's very difficult to do the classic kind of baseball broadcast that includes some anecdotes and includes some historical references and context and includes the kind of back and forth comfortable conversation between partners that differentiates a baseball broadcast from the broadcast of other sports. It's very difficult to maintain that. Let's take as the most extreme example and as the everlasting gold standard, Vin Scully. Vin Scully was a once-in-forever talent. He had a combination of qualities and talents that will never again be duplicated, but neither will the circumstances in which he worked ever be duplicated, especially toward the end of his career when he was just doing home games for the Dodgers. He's working by himself, and if people who saw some of those games will recall, there was never an extraneous graphic. The producer never dropped in a needless replay while Vin was rhapsodizing about a little kid with ice cream all over his face and a hat too big for his head and saying something like, well, he's hoping that he has a hat big enough for his dreams to grow into, or some Scully-like right. Observation. The extraneous stuff never got in the way. And that was how Vin was able to use that canvas and also connect with his audience in a way that would be impossible today. If Vin Scully were to come along today at age 30, would he still obviously be a great talent? And would he jump to the top of the heap or near the top of the heap? Sure he would. But would he be able to have the same impact? I don't think so.
We're talking to Bob Costas on the Mike Lubick podcast, and I told him last night when we decided to do this, or maybe when he gave in to my begging for him to do this, that we would be stealing a little bit from the book, but it's better to be stolen from than to have to steal. But then you reminded me of what Scully once said on this same subject.
Oh, yeah. I think it was John Miller who does an uncanny Scully imitation.
It's awesome.
What sets Miller's apart is that he does a riff where Scully's influence is so widespread that when he visits South America, he hears South American broadcasters in Spanish who sound just like they're imitating Scully. When he goes to Japan and he speaks enough Japanese and he speaks enough Spanish to make it credible, and they're all sounding like Scully. Rancido, marvelous, un escudo grande. Oh, dos y dos. So somebody points out to Scully that Miller does this great impression of him. And then says to John, well, I'd rather be the imitatee than the imitator.
We're talking to Bob Costas. Now, just without going into the great detail, because it is a great scene in our book, but talk about the day that you look over when Scully is being honored by President Obama last fall at the White House, and he's talking to Springsteen.
Well, Vin was kind enough to invite me and my wife to join him at the ceremony for the Presidential Medal of Freedom. We had dinner with some other people who were close to him the night before. And then we went to the White House. And I guess President Obama decided his last turn at the plate, he was really going to make the most of it. And this was one of the most impressive collection of accomplished individuals you could ever imagine. And I know I'm leaving some out because there were 21 of them. But off the top of my head, Robert De Niro, Robert Redford, Tom Hanks, Cicely Tyson, Ellen DeGeneres, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Michael Jordan, Diana Ross, and I'm leaving some out.
Yeah.
And Bruce Springsteen was among them, as was Scully. So, and you can't help but drop names to tell this story, so I apologize in advance. Yeah. I'm talking to Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson, and Tom is looking over my shoulder to a corner of the room just off the east room of the White House. And everybody else was pretty closely bunched together making small talk. And Tom says, what do you suppose that conversation is like? And I turn around and I see that all by themselves, it's Springsteen and Scully engrossed in conversation. And Hank says to me, what do you suppose that conversation is like? And I say, maybe it goes like this. You know, Bruce, I love Greetings from Asbury Park, but you really hit it out of the park with Darkness on the Edge of Town. Foul, back to the screen, 2-2.
We're talking to Bob Costas on the Mike Lubega podcast. It is Hall of Fame weekend in baseball. He is on his way to Cooperstown. Let's circle back to the Hall of Fame. Bonds and Clemens, are they halfway through their eligibility, Robert?
Halfway.
You believe that both of them will get in?
I do, because the electorate has changed. It includes fewer of the old-time guys and more of the younger guys who may be more lenient, if that's the right word, when it comes to PED use. And also, as more and more players get in, who are either directly linked or suspected to have used PEDs, more and more people are going to say, oh, what's the use? How can we keep the best of them out when those who are accomplished but not nearly as accomplished as Bonds and Clemens are already in? And they made a quantum leap from the high 30s, as I remember, to the mid-50s in this last voting. and they've still got 5 years to get to 75%. And even though some voters may want to make them sweat to the very end, I think ultimately they get in. What will be interesting, especially in Bond's case, is to see what the Hall of Fame speech will be like.
Talking to Bob Costas on the Mike Lupica podcast. Pace of play. I texted you on the Sunday before the All-Star break, and I had come back from playing golf with my oldest son and realized that the Yankees and the Brewers, with no rain delays, were still playing baseball at 4 o'clock after a 107 first pitch in a 5-3 game. And Bob, here's what I want to ask you. Yes, we want them to pick up the pace, but isn't it a fact of American life that if you come to baseball now, you pretty much know what you're going to get in terms of pace of play?
Yeah, you do. And when you take a look, even though it's infuriating to a lot of people that a game that used to take 2.5 hours is now taking 3.5 to 4 hours with basically the same outcomes. Even though that may be infuriating, attendance is up all around. Every measure of baseball's popularity, with the exception of national television ratings, every measure of baseball's popularity is significantly greater than it was during whatever you want to call a previous golden age. But where baseball does suffer is that it's very popular locally and regionally, but unless you get some special circumstance, like the Cubs in the World Series, or the Red Sox breaking through, or maybe if the Yankees were to play the Dodgers in the World Series, unless you get some special circumstance, baseball just doesn't measure up to what World Series ratings used to be. Now, there are a lot of factors involved in that, and pace of play is only one of them. But we are a relatively short attention span culture. And if it isn't your team, are you going to sit there for 3.5 hours, especially when there are other ways to consume it? Highlights, streaming video, go back, take a look at what's at. So you don't feel as if I don't see it now, I'm not going to see it at all. That's where I think when you get to the postseason, that's where I think pace of play is really a big concern for baseball.
Talking to Bob Costas, when it comes to baseball, by God, we want him on that wall. We need him on that wall. But, Bob, I always point out to you, not the kind of wall that the President of the United States is talking about building. I've made that clear, have I not?
Yes, you have. You have, yes.
When you look at where the game is right now, and it's funny, in the process of doing our book, I went back and looked at old games that you did. And it's not like going back and looking at the Mary Tyler Moore Show and seeing the outfits and the hairdos and all that stuff. But there is, you know, you were talking about this before, and I meant to say it at the time in this conversation. Quaint is not the word, okay? But you're right. There were fewer bells and whistles. And mm-hmm. It didn't seem like somebody had a button that wanted you to go to get to the next commercial or to get. And the game I'm thinking of is one that we deal with a lot, which was the last game of the Braves-Indians World Series. And mm-hmm. to me, everything that you bring to these broadcasts was on display. There wasn't an overwrought description of the ending of the World Series, but as they showed, and again, nobody was in a rush to leave this scene. You know, loudly you hear Albert Bell, I forget whether it's a spikes or a bat, outside the clubhouse door, and you've already gone into a thing about, you know, the disappointment of Cleveland, and there's a riff that you did there about how they were clearly the better team in the regular mm-hmm. season of these two teams. And you know, it's so funny because we do talk about pace of play in baseball. Nobody was in your ear in that moment telling you, we got to get to commercial. We got to get to commercial because Bob, it was the ending of the goddamn World Series.
Yeah, they let me tie a ribbon around it. And the basic story of that World Series was that in that 95 season, which began late because the strike had not been resolved, so they only played 144 games, and the Indians went 144 in 1995. And it's an irony that for all the postseason appearances they made and all the World Series appearances they made, the one time the Braves won it all may very well have been the time they faced the best team they ever faced in any postseason series. Certainly the best offensively, maybe not in terms of depth of pitching, but certainly the best lineup that they faced when you think about it, that mid-90s Cleveland Indians team. And so the idea was that this team, which had wreaked havoc upon just about everyone they faced through the regular season and through the playoffs, had been stymied 4 out of 6 games in October by the likes of Maddox and Smoltz and Glavin and briefly Mark Wohlers. And in that last game, they had only one hit, a soft single to right center by their catcher, Tony Pena. Everybody else, including glowering Albert Bell, completely flummoxed by the great Braves pitching staff. And what better testament to how terrific that Braves staff was that they were equal to that challenge. And as the ninth inning began, Kenny Lofton was the leadoff man. And you didn't have to be a baseball genius to figure this out. The way things were going, Kenny Lofton was their best chance. He was such a dynamic player for a period of time in the 90s. He could affect the game in so many ways. If he could have gotten on base somehow, he could have stolen second and third, and without making much noise, they might have been able to get the run that would have tied the game, because they had pulled Glavin after 8 one-hit innings and brought in Wohlers. But when Lofton fouled out to open up the inning, you got the feeling that there went their best chance. And so that's the kind of thing you try to say to put stuff in context if you can. That's your job, to put a caption beneath the picture.
This has been Bob Costas for the last hour or so, talking about baseball, a game he loves and is so knowledgeable about. And I will just tell you, having watched that game, he just did it as well in a car going to Cooperstown as he did it that night on the air. Enjoy your time in Cooperstown, my friend. Thank you for doing this today.
Thanks, Mike. We'll talk soon. Take care.
Bob Costas on the Mike Lubega podcast. There's just no better way to get ready for Hall of Fame weekend in baseball. He will be up there. He is often up there. He has several responsibilities up there. And again, keep downloading this podcast. Keep subscribing. Leave comments today. Our audience grows every week, and it's because of conversations like this, which means it's because of guests like Bob. I'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.